I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton,
I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing, podcats? Welcome to podcast number 45. Once again, I'm away from home, missing Rosie and the fields of East Anglia and my family. Not in that order. I don't know, maybe. This time, I'm in Birmingham, and I'm just about to do a Bug David Bowie special tonight. You might be able to hear the walk-in music playing. I'm on stage in 17 minutes. And I was in Oxford last night. That was fun. And in Brighton the night before that at the Dome, which was great. And, you know, after the horrible events at the concert in Manchester on Monday, it's actually been really good to be able to get away from home and out and about and visit a few cities and see people getting on with their lives and with each other. And I get to listen to a lot of David Bowie, so that cheers me up. And other people too, I hope. So, on we go. Podcast number 45 features a conversation with British director Edgar Wright. He directed Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, Scott Pilgrim, The World's End, and the forthcoming Baby Driver, as well as a lot of great, great television projects. Spaced, I suppose, being the most obvious one. But he's done a lot, Edgar. We recorded this conversation in March of this year, 2017, in the kitchen of a London apartment that Edgar was staying in. And I had a cold, or a sort of weird throat thing. So sometimes I sound as if I've just woken up after a long, sexy night. Some of you might enjoy that. If not, I apologize. So this is not so much a career overview with Edgar as a ramble down memory lane, in the course of which we recall how we got to know each other in the early 2000s, when we'd often find ourselves at parties and events at a venue called the TARDIS in Clerkenwell. It's not there any longer. That's where the expanded Farringdon Station now sits. But we mentioned the TARDIS in our conversation, so I thought I'd tell you what it was. Edgar and I also confessed to our involvement in a series of entertainment industry scams, there's no other word for them, perpetrated in the early parts of our careers, and these revelations will almost certainly rock the industry to its very core. We also hear how Edgar helped Matt Lucas and David Walliams achieve their comedy potential, sort of. And we discuss the awkward time when my wife, Jo Cornish, first began spending a lot of time with Edgar, even though Edgar was supposedly in a stable and loving relationship with Simon Pegg. Edgar and Joe ended up writing on Steven Spielberg's Tintin film together, as well as on the first iteration of Ant-Man for Marvel Studios. Something that meant Joe ended up spending less and less time with his hairy husband and their Six Music podcast baby. Yeah, I know. Anyway, I hope you'll enjoy hearing myself and Edgar skipping nimbly between light-hearted banter and seething resentment. I'm joking. There's no seething resentment. All right. There's also plenty of awkward celebrity encounter chat, high-level name-dropping, and Hot Fuzz memories. But to warm up the inconsequential waffles, I start by reminding Edgar of the story I told Louis Theroux on podcast number 10 about the time I went to see the film Sunshine with Edgar, and I ate a stinky sandwich in the cinema. Oh, Mike. Hey. Mike's the promoter of the shows. How are you doing, Mike?
Good. A little embarrassed that I've walked in on you doing this.
But... just doing the podcast intro. Mike, you've just joined The Fall.
Yeah. Weird.
This is true, listeners. Mike is a Manchester guy, and he knows some of the members of the band The Fall. And how did you get invited to join?
On a WhatsApp group. He said, does anyone want to play keys in the fall? And I said yes, and I was first, so I got the gig.
That's how you join the fall. You got to be in WhatsApp. I'm not on WhatsApp. That's why I'm not in any exciting bands at the moment.
I think it's because I lived in Manchester for 35 years now. It's my turn. I took a ticket at the deli counter, and now it's my go. So.
What are you playing?
Keys, synths.
Complicated melody lines there?
No, never more than three notes at a time. That's how I keep it anyway. So, yeah, nice and easy.
Right, man. I'm on stage in 10 minutes, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Here we go, podcats. I'll speak to you later. Tell the story about when you and I went to see Sunshine and I started eating a sandwich.
It's funny.
And then I got food poisoning as punishment for bad cinema etiquette.
The thing is, I'd heard that secondhand through people talking about it on the podcast.
Yeah.
And I only have a vague recollection of it.
Of the smell of chicken stuffing.
Now that you're here, now I'm getting a sense memory of it. But when I heard it secondhand from other people saying like, people saying, oh, is Adam really pissed you off once eating a sandwich? I said, I don't remember that, to be honest.
I don't think I probably...
I just gave you an odd look, probably.
No, you shifted uncomfortably. And I said, I was talking to Louis about it. And I said, quite rightly, you know, it's not on. It's not something I do now. And now that I've got children, and when I used to go to the cinema with them a lot, I remember the earliest memories I have are of being acutely aware of not wanting to disturb other cinema goers. I mean, generally, when you're going to the movies with children, all bets are off.
Yeah.
If it's a kid's film, you know, it's just a melee. But if I was going to see maybe a 12 or something where the audience is a bit more mixed, it's not exclusively children, then I'd be quite anxious about the boys making too much noise or munching too loudly in quiet scenes. All these things that as adults you know instinctively. As children you have to learn them. Like, mate, you don't munch in a quiet scene. You wait for some explosions and then you start munching.
I had a thing the other day where I went to see Scorsese's Silence.
Right.
I saw it in Los Angeles
over Christmas. It's a long one, isn't it? How long is that?
It's like 2¾ hours long.
Okay. But it feels a lot longer, apparently.
I'll say this, is I'm glad I saw it. It's a very powerful ending, and so it's not something that I necessarily think I'll be in a rush to revisit.
Yeah.
I think Silence is actually sort of a worthy one, but sometimes with awards films at the end of the year, I call them like broccoli movies.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, I have to watch this.
It's edifying. Yeah, it's good for you. It's good for your moral fiber.
Yeah. So maybe to counteract the potential worthiness of it, I bought a big bag of M&Ms. And then I thought, I'll make these M&Ms last through the 2¾ hours running time. But then in the movie, the whole movie is about kind of priests from Spain being tortured in Japan. And Adam Driver and Andrew Garfield are so stick thin and obviously went on a brutal weight loss regime to get into shape for the movie. And I texted Andrew Garfield. This is my first name drop of many, okay. But I texted him later after I'd seen the movie. But then I said, as I was eating the M&Ms, I started to feel that you were looking down on me from the screen for this transgression, that I was like doing something really bad. And that you and I start to feel like the characters would really want the M&Ms right now, whilst they were being like captured and tortured.
What was his reply?
He thought it was funny. Yeah. I think it was lol.
Lol. I'm eating M&Ms now.
Lol.
Are you quite a tolerant cinema goer generally, or do you get upset quite easily by bad manners in cinemas?
I get annoyed by people who think they can't be seen looking at their iPhone. It's like, I can see you, cunt. It's like, I don't care if you're hiding it in your jacket. It's still in my field of vision.
Yeah.
So I hate that. And I was really used really strong language there to sort of apologize.
That's what this podcast is all about. strong language, strong opinions.
David Walliams gets very annoyed at the cinema. And one time we were watching Get Carter was re-released at the cinema. We went to see it, I think, at the Plaza on Regent Street. And two sort of bearded men, older than us, but guys who'd obviously had like 4 pints. We're enjoying the movie, but doing that thing where they were basically saying the lines before they came on screen.
Right, they thought it was Rocky Horror or something.
Yeah, which you can imagine how irritating that is.
Yeah.
We must have been in our early 20s, and these guys were in their sort of 30s, but they seemed more sort of like masculine than either me or Walliams.
They probably were.
And Walliams stuck his face through the gap in the seat in between these guys and said, "Shut the fuck up and watch the fucking film, you morons." And I was like both incredibly impressed and then had that feeling of like, we are going to die tonight.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are going to kill us.
Because what are the chances that a couple of beery guys are going to say, "Oh, sorry."
They did shut up. I then spent the rest of the film thinking that we were going to get stabbed afterwards.
Yeah, hard to enjoy it after that.
Well, it's quite a tense film, so maybe it added to
okay.
it. Okay. There were no reprisals, but I was like, you know when somebody is like your raw, would it be id? What would it be? Where somebody is like saying exactly what you're thinking.
Uh-huh.
And the Walliams did it. It was like, I was thinking it, and then he said it. And he said it in no uncertain terms. Like, Walliams, not just to say, "Shut the fuck up and watch the film, you fucking morons."
He's
it's
just
like using the word moron is quite a strong word, isn't it?
Yeah. That would be the last one I would reach for in a public confrontation.
This is, I must stress, this is an earlier Walliams.
An earlier incarnation of
Walliams from probably about like late 90s, early
2000s. Hadn't written any children's books at that point.
Pre-success.
Yeah, he always seemed quite like angsty and angry before he got really well known. And now he seems a little bit more, you know what I mean? Like, usually it goes the other way. You know, people are lighthearted, then they become successful and they turn into like big bags of douche.
I think there's something. We were just talking about that at lunch, actually, because I think in terms of careers and stuff, it's not, obviously, like, talent plays a big part of it, but tenacity plays an equally big part. You have to kind of like
keep at it.
And I think sort of those guys, you know, I was always very proud of them because they sort of went through sort of
Matt and Dave, you're talking about.
Yeah, several ups and downs before then it finally kind of hit. And I was involved in one of their TV shows, actually, two of them I did. I actually did the one that kind of like knocked them off the BBC for a while.
What was that one?
Sir Bernard's Stately Homes.
Oh, yeah.
So they were on like a sort of path where they had done, I'd done I should back up a little bit with them because actually,
they'd done Rock Profiles by that point.
No, Rock Profiles was afterwards. This is the thing, this is how the way things work, but it's fascinating, is the Rock Profiles in a way was seen as like maybe a little come down initially because it was like they had a chance of doing a show on the BBC on proper network TV. It didn't do well and it got really bad reviews. And then sort of tail slightly between their legs, the only thing that they could get on the BBC was like, "Oh, would you like to do links in between these videos?" So I think initially it was something that like, "Oh, I guess we better do it because we don't have any other offers."
And it was even on BBC Three, wasn't it?
Well, BBC Choice at
Choice
the time.
As it was, yeah.
So, but then they turned that into gold. Do you know what I mean? And then it's like that's what started sort of that phenomenon of the two of them kind of like happening was doing those silly rock profiles things that were still really funny.
Yeah. Listeners, if you haven't seen them, you can find them on YouTube, presumably.
Yeah.
I remember the one with the Bee Gees where he was like
Barry Gibb.
A lion.
And he was the other two, makeup. Robin and Maurice, couldn't talk
right
unless he clicked his fingers for one and rang a bell for the other.
And it was before
the other there classic was one is the Tom Jones, Shirley Bassey one. That's I think those are the two like best ones. Tom Jones and Shirley Bassey and the Bee Gees ones are
with
fantastic.
Matt as Shirley Bassey.
Yeah. Haven't got the range.
Yeah. Very. they were great. And it was before really people had properly got stuck into lampooning celebrities, as far as I recall, for like comedic purposes. Like, was it even pre-Beau Selector?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
But you did your best to make things go wrong for them.
I owe them my break in a way, because we sort of tangentially sort of linked. We could come back to that in a second. But the first TV job I ever had in 1995, when I was 21 years old, was I directed Matt and Dave in a sketch show for the Paramount Comedy Channel called Mash and Peas.
Oh, yeah.
And how that came about was because I had made my first movie when I was 20, and I had moved to London to edit it.
Fistful of Fingers.
Yes. which was a 16 mil film that cost like 20 grand.
There was a clip of that in Takeover TV, wasn't there?
There was, of the original Video 8 version. I did two versions of that movie. I did one on video, and then after art college, I reshot it on film.
Takeover TV, listeners, was the show that Joe and I first did on Channel 4.
Yeah. I know, it was funny, around that time, so we never met through Takeover TV, but obviously I saw it all, and you were very sort of prominent in it, and very funny, and it was obvious. Well, it was funny, I have there's a couple of things linked there, is... So I had sent things into Takeover TV, and as I recall, they didn't give you any fee for the clips on that show?
No, it was pretty bargain basement. It was a show, for those who haven't seen it, that was, well, it was a bit like YouTube.
Mm.
But it was mainly, you know, it was public access, I suppose, because there was never really a thriving public access scene in the UK the way that there is in a lot of towns in the States. People were encouraged to send in home videos. So there was, the first series of this show was all people sort of going, why aren't the council doing anything about the terrible state of the bin areas and all this sort of stuff? Because that was like what real people were like, apparently.
Yeah.
But then, of course, there was all these people like you and like me and Joe and lots of other people making stupid, fun videos that you now kind of see on YouTube. And so eventually we started getting that stuff in. We were two of the people, myself and Joe, who went through a lot of the tapes that were sent in.
Yes.
It was 95% dog shit. I mean, just absolutely worthless, because we're desperate. Like, anything half good, we're going to stick it on. I mean, you said generously that we were funny on that show. I mean, I couldn't really watch that program now without getting very sad.
Well, I remember I had the hunt with them, and I remember I was mad because I watched one of the episodes, and I'd sent in this like hour-long film, and they had cut it up into chunks and just spread it throughout an episode.
Yes.
Which meant that any time it returned to it, it had no credit. And that kind of really annoyed me because, you know, the only thing you've got, if you're not getting paid, the only thing you've got is that your credit is on there. So then, like, clips of it would be on with no credit. And I was like, would it kill you to just put up the name of the filmmaker every time it comes up?
Yes, yes. No, there were lots of things like that. I mean, unfortunately, yes, there wasn't the same level of respect that you would, that would be in place nowadays with that kind of show.
Well, get this. I'm sure I've told you this story before, but around the same time as Takeover TV... the only job in TV that I ever had when I wasn't directing, I was very, very fortunate to start young, and that was through Matt and Dave seeing my film. But in between finishing art college in 94, shooting this silly first film in that summer, I then moved to London to edit it, edited the movie on absolutely no money, and sort of didn't really have the money to properly finish the film initially. So I had to get a job, and I got a job. It was my only non-directing TV job. I was a researcher on a show called Beadle's Hot Shots.
Oh, right.
Which was essentially like the mainstream ITV version of Takeover TV.
That's right. I remember being very upset about it.
Well,
thinking, Beadle, he's only gone and stolen our idea but done it all slick and mainstream.
Well, here's the funny thing with that show. So Beadle's Hot Shots was a spin-off of You've Been Framed, which for... international listeners is like the British version of America's Funniest Home Videos. And you would get for a clip of somebody falling over 250 quid.
Yeah.
On Beatles Hot Shots, the idea is viewers send in their sketches. And it was £500 per clip. And that is in 1994 money. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
So it'd be a lot of money now if they had that. So here's the thing, is I was involved in the pilot and they used one of my clips from Fistful of Fingers. In fact, I don't think Fistful of Fingers was in Takeover TV. I think the clips in Takeover TV were from a different film called Dead Right, which was a cop movie,
Sort
of became the tiny seed for Hot Fuzz.
I just remember a guy in a shootout shoving the barrel of a gun through the back of someone's head so that it came out of his mouth and then he carried on shooting.
That was Dead Right, yeah.
Okay.
Which is actually on the Hot Fuzz DVD as like an extra. So I was involved in the pilot of Beatles Hot Shots and they showed clips of the video version of Fistful of Fingers and I got my 500 quid. And then the producer asked me to be a researcher on the show and to basically do exactly what you were talking about. It's like, look through the sketches.
Search through the dog shit.
Yes. So, but here's the thing. And this is, and I've never really told this story properly before. I've sort of alluded to it. Beatles Hot Shots was not a hit. If it had been a big hit, this would have been a News of the World sort of scandal on a Sunday morning. So that show was on ITV and it was 6 half hours. And I would say that a third of the clips I shot myself.
Oh.
Because, as you just said, the actual submissions, there was not enough to fill 6.5 hours.
Yeah.
So this is the two things that happened. And I can tell the story now because Jeremy Beadle is no longer with us. Also, he had absolutely no knowledge that I was fabricating some of the clips. But there basically was not enough stuff. Idea number one was, okay, go through what there is and we'll pick out the best ones. And there were some good ones, but not enough for 6.5 hours. Number two is take the clips that are like good ideas but terribly shot and go and reshoot them for the people. So that was something that I did on that show.
And would you get in touch with those people and explain that that's what you were going to do?
Yeah, I would get in touch with them directly. But it would be something where it was me as, and I was a 20-year-old researcher. So it wouldn't really be sort of any more official than that. It's like, oh, I'm working on Beatles Hot Shots. We really like your sketch, but it's not broadcastable.
I'm sorry to say that it's too dog shit.
So I basically, I re-edited a lot of clips with the editor on the shows. I made them better. I reshot some with members of the public, which was actually, even though it was, you know, immediately breaking the premise of the show, it was actually a lot of fun.
And I'm sure, yeah.
But I always thought about that in terms of, and then there were some sketches where there still wasn't enough to fill 6.5 hours. That me and my brother and my friends just shot stuff, usually without our faces in it. Jeremy Beadle had no idea at all. And in fact, even the checks for 500 quid, because they had to send them somewhere, were like sent to like my dad instead of me.
Okay. Oh my God, so you even got the money.
Well, they had to, it was like, yeah. I guess to balance the books, sure. Is like sort of...
Complete the charade.
But I always thought if that show had been a bigger hit, that would have been a proper scandal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it might still be.
We'll find out. Jeremy Beadle, God bless you. I'm sorry. You didn't know anything about it, so he's completely innocent.
But, but the thing is that pre the BBC scandals, I guess the Queen was the watershed, wasn't it?
What was the Queen one?
The Queen was when they re-edited a sequence in a documentary about the royal family.
Oh, yeah.
To make it look as if the Queen...
She walked out on Annie Leibovitz.
Right. Was pissed off.
Was that what it was?
Exactly, right, yeah. And actually, they just reordered the sequence a little bit to make it to reinforce their narrative, and it was a massive, massive scandal. And the BBC was never the same, and now has to run through all sorts of checks and balances to ensure absolute transparency. Quite right, to ensure that the license payers aren't being swindled. But even when we were on XFM, I remember doing competitions in 2006, and you'd have to have competitions. They were foisted upon you. It's like, all right, you got the 10-1 slot on a Saturday. What competitions are you going to do, kind of thing? We got all the stuff that we give away, and we're like, okay, we'll come up with some competition. So we came up with some lame stuff and said, all right, competition time. We had a little jingle and everything, and no one would enter. Because, you know, why would they? Either there weren't enough people listening, or the people that were listening just thought, I'm not going to enter a competition.
So you'd have to make up winners.
So we'd make up mates. And you just say, listen, you know, would you pretend to be a person that has entered this competition? It didn't always happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But it did happen once or twice.
Yeah.
And you just do it for the sake of filling up airtime and keeping the show running. Because the alternative was just a sort of humiliating climb down. You may remember we launched the competition in the last half hour. Well, no one's entered. And I think we're not going to be able to do the competition now. So... forget we ever mentioned it. Here's the darkness. So you have that. Everyone did that. That's just the way things work. It's like, duh. Sometimes there's not the enthusiasm. So you have to... It's entertainment. It's showbiz. That's what it is. Then the idea that everything had to be 100% real just seemed bizarre. I mean, it can't be now.
I think about it like sort of... it was something where I was in London for the first time. I was working at London TV Centre. I mean, I was getting paid, but also, like, I knew how to order cabs all of a sudden, which is like, oh, shit. It's like, yeah, I know what the cab number is, and I know what the account number is.
Cab
and
on
I'm
account.
I'm never paying for a cab ever again.
Cab on account. Those were the days. And then someone would always, there'd be one person that ruined it by sort of going to Manchester or something when they were...
I ruined, in one of the edit suites where I had a little edit suite where I could watch tapes and sometimes edit things, there was a phone there. And I would just make long distance calls all the time. And then it got cut off. So I ruined that one.
It's one of the greatest feelings in life, though, to suddenly stumble upon a little loophole like
the money
that,
tap. Like, yeah. Like, oh, hello.
It's like someone, there was
nobody's checking on this. I'm just going to abuse it.
Someone's just forgotten about this. I'm just going to use it and use it and use it until it stops. It's great.
Wow, we've talked about Takeover TV and Beatles Hot Shots.
But what's funny about this is that we were sort of involved in the same show.
Yeah.
But probably didn't meet until like 5 years later.
I met you through Joe, I remember.
I remember I met Joe in the cinema store, which is now no longer with us. And we had that thing, which I'm sure would have happened if I'd met you first as well, where it's like, oh, we're on the same channel at the same time. We should say hello to each other.
Because you were making Space at that time.
Yeah, Space was on Channel 4, and the Adam and Joe show was also on Channel 4, but we'd never actually met through Channel 4. So I'm trying to think where I first met you.
I feel like I first met you at Joe's flat in Exmouth Market.
Was it when we watched the Oscars or something at Joe's?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Stayed up and watched the Oscars?
That sounds right.
Yeah, and then I remember also coming to an Adam and Joe rap party in Clerkenwell.
Yeah, at the TARDIS.
At the TARDIS. And a couple of interesting things happened there. I remember... Maybe that's where I met Garth Jennings for the first time.
Uh-huh.
But I remember also after that, as chronicled in his biography, Nick Frost got brutally beaten by a group of teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
That was after your party. And I remember because he was in he was very drunk, and I was trying to get him to come back to my house because I was a bit worried about him. And he was like, no, I've got to watch the boxing. There was some fight going on.
Yeah.
There was going to be a fight at 3 in the morning. And I think he went to a kebab shop or a chip shop or something. And then got like sort of pounced upon by and went to hospital.
Oh no.
So I actually got home and then I got a text from Simon like at 5 a.m. saying Nick's in intensive care.
Oh no.
And he was just set upon. That was after the TARDIS. Prior to that, the party had been delightful.
Hey, everybody in the modern time, they got to get themselves a podcast. I will do yours and you'll do mine.
We're sorting out the problems of the world so fast.
This is weird, isn't it? We're just sitting here. Like, this is like being in a time machine now. I haven't thought about all this stuff for so long. Exactly.
I mean, it's one of the nice things about this industry is when the sort of world gets smaller and meeting you guys. And I think through that same nexus, Garth Jennings and Shinola and Nigel Godrich... It's always a nice feeling when the world gets smaller.
Yeah, because you went on, of course, to do quite a bit with Nigel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, he's done something on the new film as well. So
right. I mean, he was heavily involved with Scott Pilgrim, wasn't he?
Yeah. He did the whole score for that, which was his first score. And it was great. It was a great experience.
Mm.
I always remember that very sort of fondly, that period, because it wasn't like Channel 4 organized these socials themselves, but we were all on the same channel. And then it was that just the sort of kismet of actually running into each other properly in the streets, you know?
Yeah, it was a really fun, fruitful time. And it was nice to root for everyone because I really, you know, I loved your stuff. I loved Spaced.
The first person who told me about the Adam and Joe show in 96 was Matt Lucas.
Oh, yeah.
He said, have you been watching this thing, Adam and Joe show on Channel 4? These guys are really good. I'm telling you, they're the future. He said something very prophetic like that. And I think, but I will admit, I didn't take his advice and didn't watch it for like a year. I remember him saying he was the first person in sort of comedy circles that I'd heard rave about it.
Oh, well, he was sort of right. I mean, to the extent that we do exist.
In the future.
In the future.
Well, I brought my friend to your 20th anniversary show at the BFI. I brought along Phil Lord, who is the director of the Lego movie and 21 Jump Street and 22 Jump Street and upcoming Han Solo movie and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Those are his full credits in the wrong order.
Busy. And he's only like about 13 or something, isn't he?
No, he's my age. I think we're the same age.
Oh,
like,
really?
So I'm 42. I think he's 41.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm glad.
But he only knew Joe through Attack the Block and through meeting him with me. And he didn't know, and I said, oh, you should come to this and you should see Joe's, like, sort of, like...
Baby steps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's not even that. It's just, like, I mean, but their show was great. And, like, I sort of... it's funny because I also used to listen to the podcast all the time. So when I was maybe whisking Joe away to write and then he wasn't doing the podcast, I would feel like it was my fault.
Well, good. Good. I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, I can say that because also as a listener, I was like, why aren't they doing the podcast
anymore?
Why aren't they doing
the podcast? Oh, is it because Joe's in LA with me, poncing around in a manner that will almost certainly be driving Adam to incredible levels of distraction and insecurity? Yes, that is the reason.
So So I'll fully take the blame if it makes you feel better.
What was the first thing you did together then?
We had sort of become pally probably around the same time that me and Simon were writing Shaun of the Dead. But as you know, like sort of also when somebody has another career, it's also something that I was trying to find somebody else to write with because I loved writing with Simon, but Simon would frequently have a job and then disappear.
Yeah.
So
he thought, I'll steal...
steal Adam's someone writing partner.
I'll ruin a marriage that seems very happy. I'll just cruise in there, I'll snog that guy.
If it makes me feel better, Simon always used to feel weird about it as well.
Yeah, I remember talking to Simon about it.
Well, the thing that we first started writing, funny enough, we had written a treatment for... It wasn't even for Marvel. It was kind of for ourselves. I had seen this... I'd gone into this meeting at a company called Artisan that no longer exist. And they said, oh, we have some of the Marvel properties. And they showed me this list. And the list was all like the B and C and D properties, not the big ones. And I immediately sort of pointed at Ant-Man. I said, oh, I know that character. And so me and Joe, this must have been 2001, we went away and wrote a treatment.
2001?
Yes, it was that far back. For sure. Maybe it's 2002, but it definitely predated actually
making... He was cheating on me in 2001.
So what's... I think it definitely predated Shaun of the Dead. And I remember the people at Artisan, when they read our treatment, said, oh, it's really cool, but it's a bit edgier than we were imagining. We wanted something more like, you know, an Eddie Murphy type film. So they wanted something that was more like a sort of a Dr. Dolittle-y thing and not what we had written, which was like a sort of Mission Impossible... sort of Bourne-style superhero movie. So then that was 2001, so it just went away. And then after Shaun of the Dead, then the real Marvel came along and they said, are you interested in any of the properties? I said, well, actually, me and my friend wrote this thing in 2001. So we had written this treatment that far back and then basically we picked up on it. And then whilst me and Simon were writing Hot Fuzz, Simon had to go at 4 and do a voiceover. And then Joe came in. And you know that thing where somebody sort of comes in, this must be like having a mistress or something, is that like Joe came 5 minutes early and Simon hadn't quite left yet.
Yeah. And they're sort of shuffling around awkwardly.
And Simon's like, oh, hey, man. Oh, yeah. So are you guys writing? How's it going? So then asking about the other thing that we're writing, how's it going and stuff. And then Joe had sat in Simon's warm seat to then start writing with me on something else. As I was walking down the fire escape, now starting to feel a bit put out. And I remember as a joke, he got to the bottom of the fire escape, it was just three floors down, and then he shouted up, don't forget me! So if it used to annoy you, take some comfort in the fact that it used to annoy Simon as well.
I did talk to Simon after doing Hot Fuzz, actually, at some sort of get-together after that. I remember Paddy Considine mooching around terrifying people in some darkened room and you and Nick off in one corner. And I ended up talking to Simon and saying, yeah, it was weird, wasn't it? Was it weird for you? And yeah, it was very cathartic that we both had more or less exactly the same insecurities about it. I was really insecure because, you know, I wanted to write with Joe. We wanted to do movies together. That was always part of our... plan was to do something like that, but we just couldn't get it together. Just the actual business of sitting in a room and writing with someone else, there's so much going on. But for me, I mean, I would think that you and I are people who are quite similar temperamentally in some ways. You know, we're not the kind of people who can easily just take criticism and have it completely bounce off us. You know, we're not so confident that we can just chuck any old idea out there and feel absolutely nothing if it gets squashed by the other people in the room. There's all those things you have to deal with.
It's a very difficult thing writing with anybody. And I think there's also a thing where I think when I wrote with Simon, I would be like the good cop. And Simon would be the sort of like the slightly, I'll say this, you know, like this is not a criticism at all, but the somewhat lazy genius. When I say that is like what he did write is amazing, but then it's just sometimes you feel like sort of concentrate, man. And it's funny, like you say about kind of getting insecure and embittered and stuff. Like you probably wouldn't think of it in any way am insecure about Shaun of the Dead. However, at the time when that film came out, a thing that used to happen, which is absolutely not Simon's fault at all, used to kind of gnaw away at me, was that sometimes reviewers would sort of say star and writer Simon Pegg and direct Edgar Wright, and that would drive me bonkers.
Right.
And it's such a tiny thing because it's like sort of a little mistake.
Yeah.
But it's like, I co-wrote that
Clues
movie.
In the name! Edgar Wright!
So, but I know that's so silly, but it happened on more than one occasion.
Sure, I know those things.
And it sort of starts to kind of, because then people sort of like, and I think one of the reasons was because I didn't co-write Space. So I think then some people just assumed that I didn't write Shaun of the Dead, and it really used to annoy me. And it was never Simon's fault. It's not that Simon would ever do that. But it was that thing, like this kind of weird, like sort of like black growing, like bile inside you.
Terrible.
That went away with Hot Fuzz. I think sort of that didn't become an issue anymore. And I think mainly because a lot of the stories about the development of that was the fact that it was based on my hometown and everything. And although weirdly, in the I think it was in the Observer last week, I had to contact the Observer because there was an article about, I think it was about Nick. Oh, it was about Simon, and it said, in 2007, Peg co-wrote the hit film Hot Fuzz with his best mate, Nick Frost. The thing is, like, I love both these people. It's not their fault. But I am writing to The Guardian to get them to correct it. It's like, I actually wrote Hot Fuzz.
Actually, I think you'll find...
Actually, you think you'll find that I am the credited co-writer on Hot Fuzz. I know if you're listening at home and you think that this sounds insane that, and I'm anyway like annoyed about this, I apologize. And I'm just trying to... You know,
yeah, you're being candid. I appreciate your candor.
It's so stupid, but it's like something
I think that,
like,
that most people can relate. I really do. I think there are very few people who are so supremely confident that these kinds of things don't get to them. And those people are generally quite difficult to be around, I find.
It's funny. But what's the, here's the irony though. That is how we got the job on Tintin. It was actually Peter Jackson who first, he asked me and Simon to rewrite Tintin because Stephen Moffat was writing it and he'd done like four drafts and Stephen Moffat wanted to leave. It's like, I've got to go back home and start doing Doctor Who or Sherlock. I'm probably Sherlock at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So Simon wasn't really around. He was like shooting Mission Impossible or something. And so I said, oh, there's this guy, Joe. Because I knew Joe was a big Tintin fan. So apologies if this then wrecked months and months of great podcast that I would have enjoyed. I'm only ruining my own life.
Garth stepped in and he did a great job.
I know, I heard it.
He was better than Joe a lot of the time.
So that's how that came about. And so basically, like, and then what happened is I had to leave. I did two drafts on Tintin because I was about to start shooting Scott Pilgrim. And then Joe sort of stayed on as the sole writer for a while. So I always thought that was amusing to me, was that like initially it was me and Simon asked to do Tintin. Simon can't really do it. Me and Joe were at the draft. Now I can't really do it. And then Joe is suddenly in a room with Spielberg, Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, Kathy Kennedy. So it was like, there's a thing like, so when you're meeting Steven Spielberg, you're so aware, and this is such a sort of stupid thing, it's like sort of like, oh, I really want you. With anybody like that, when somebody's a hero of yours, it's like sort of, how can I be impressive? It's like, don't just say like the obvious things.
Yeah,
do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
I was at a party in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and you know sometimes when you're not ready for something, my agent came and said, would you like to meet Mick Jagger? And I was like, yeah, what now? Like, and I'm just not ready. And he said, sure, come and meet Mick. And then you're being escorted by your elbow to meet Mick Jagger. And you're thinking, I'm not ready for this. And then suddenly you're standing in like a sycophancy circle where Mick's meeting and greeting lots of people and being really nice. And then suddenly, like, without any prep whatsoever, your window is arrived
to
talk to some... He's not a Sir Mick Jagger. He's just Mick Jagger.
Is he Sir? He may well be.
Mick Jagger.
I think he is. I think he is because...
Sir Mick.
Because Keith Richards writes with entertaining contempt about the fact that he accepted the knighthood.
So get this, and this isn't embarrassing to admit. What do you do when you suddenly have 10 seconds with Mick Jagger?
Yeah.
Okay, so he had just come in from New York. And I think at the time New York was in a cold snap. And literally, it just sounds like the worst kind of like first date, worst speed dating ever. Is suddenly you're talking to Mick Jagger and Brian says, oh, this is my agent, says, Mick, this is Edgar, one of my clients, a very talented director. And he said, oh, nice to meet you. I said, oh, you just got in from New York. Was it cold? It's such a lame, just talk about the weather to Mick Jagger. And he goes, oh, yeah, freezing, just being nice. And then suddenly, like, your time is already wrapping up.
Yeah.
And then you get in very quickly. A huge fan, by the way. It's awful. Awful.
Huge fan, by the way.
I know, it's awful. So get this. So now to back up. Spielberg. There's a thing where me and Joe would always, like, act out the voices. So we'd sort of do, it'd be funny, like, in front of Steven Spielberg, sort of doing a Tintin voice or doing a Haddock voice. And when I was Tintin, and this is just a default thing of maybe, like, who he is, I would sort of, Joe would say to me afterwards, he says, "Why do you keep grabbing Steven's arm when you're explaining a bit?" And that was, he accused me of getting over familiar that I kept touching Steven Spielberg's arm when I was trying to make a point or trying to make a joke. I was like, "It's like this," and like grabbing his arm. And I was. And I was like, way too over familiar. And Joe said, "You keep touching his arm. It looks weird." I was like, I just want to see that he's real.
All these complex webs of insecurity and jealousy being woven.
I had the much, much, much better version of the Mick Jagger thing.
Yeah.
Was I met Ray Davis last year.
Oh, right.
Who's a genuine hero. Also Sir Ray Davis. Sir Ray Davis. I'm a huge Kinks fan. And Mark Hamill did a talk with him for the Big Issue at Hornsey Town Hall. And it was funny because I had met Mark Hamill at a screening.
Yeah.
And I think Simon knew him already. So it's the first time I'd ever met Mark Hamill, who couldn't be nicer. And he was in town shooting the new Star Wars movie. And he said, "Oh, let's get together in London." So I sort of, I had his email and said, "Let's have dinner or something." And he goes, "Are you a Kinks fan?" I said, "Yes, I am a huge Kinks fan." He goes, "Well, I'm interviewing Ray Davis on Sunday night. Do you want to come to that?" I said, "Yes." So the Mick Jagger thing makes me still cringe even thinking about it. It's like, what an awful, awful waste of 10 seconds of his life. To ask him about
I'm
the
sure
weather.
He's still furious
big,
about it.
Big fan, by the way. Ugh, yeah. Awful. But Ray Davis, Ray Davis was in this dressing room, and I said to Mike, "Can you introduce me to Ray Davis?" And he came out, "Oh, Ray, this is Edgar Wright. He directed Shaun of the Dead." And then Ray Davis said to me, he goes, "The Winchester's around the corner from my house." Because he lives on Highgate Hill. And the real pub where Simon and Nick used to hang out was called The Shepherds. It's now The Boogaloo. And then one down, and that's essentially The Shepherds in Highgate, now The Boogaloo, was what we based the film on. But one pub down, there was a place called the Winchester Park Tavern. It's now been knocked down. So Ray Davis informed me that the Winchester had been knocked down.
Right.
So it was the sweetest thing. It was like, oh, he's actually asking me things.
Yeah, he's engaging with you. That's
engaging
great.
With me. But there's another flip to this that then quite makes sense. It's just so thinking, oh my God, like Ray Davis has seen the film. And he goes, "Yeah, I know. I live around the corner from the Winchester." He goes, "Love that film. Great stuff. Great stuff." I was thinking, oh my God, thank you so much. And I said, "Of course, I'm a big fan. I said, I used two of your songs in Hot Fuzz." And then he looked completely lost. Like thinking, "You aren't aware that I used two of your songs in Hot Fuzz." Because he just tapped me on the arm and goes, "Good stuff, mate." he said, "Good on you, mate." But I kind of thought, I got that sense of thinking, he has no idea that two of his songs are in Hot Fuzz.
They would have checked with him. They don't they have to?
I think maybe
or they just check with the publishers.
Maybe. I suspect when you're that big and your songs are that well used, that maybe just residuals checks start flowing in and like the actual, you know, source of them is not important after a while.
I would have thought that he'd be fairly careful.
Maybe. Yeah, sometimes people are not kind of completely aware that you use their stuff.
I mean, that song,
anyway, it was so,
that song is almost, that Village Green Preservation Society is almost the template for the whole film, isn't it? I mean, they're lyrically.
It's weird. There's two things with Hot Fuzz and The World's End. One is that somebody on Twitter said, "Have you thought that The World's End is a prediction of Brexit?" Because at the end of the movie, Simon's character, Gary King, tell the all-powerful network to, like, fuck off, you know, like, we'll make our own mistakes. You know, nobody tells us what to do. And the network in the movie are so sort of tired of the ignorant, belligerent humans that they leave the planet and send us back into the Dark Ages. That's the end of that movie. And then somebody said, "Do you not think that Gary King sort of... telling the network to fuck off." It's like, yeah, it's Farage triggering like Article 50. I thought, you're right.
Right.
And then even weirder, in Hot Fuzz, Jim Broadbent's character says, "Whatever the cost, we will make Sanford great again."
Ah.
He says that out loud. And so I think sort of, I've had several, because I think Hot Fuzz is the only film of mine that's on Netflix. And I've had several people have said the same thing. Saying, "Was watching Hot Fuzz to take my mind off election anxieties And then Jim Broadbent says, "We will make Sanford great again."
That film is, my Twitter timeline lights up every time it's on, obviously.
People ask me, this is something I'm going to answer a question, because I get asked it all the time.
Yeah.
People say, "Do you get paid every time it's on ITV2? And the answer is no.
No.
So, no, I don't. And I have no control over it being... I'm very flattered, though, that it is on TV all the time. It's a very... I mean, Sean and Hot Fuzz are on TV all the time. And that can only mean that it still rates. There's the only reason that they keep putting it on.
Well, it's so good. I watch it. I like it more every time I see it. It's one of those films, actually, that I do sit and watch. And sometimes I forget that I pop up in it.
I was the other day, I was flicking through the channels and it was on, and I couldn't stop watching the last half, and I fucking made the movie.
Yeah. Stupid. It's got lots of funny stuff, Mike. What was it that really made me laugh? When Nick gets hit in the head by the bin is the first real big laugh for me. And the other thing that really makes me laugh is when Carl Johnson, who plays one of the old coppers, just keeps saying, "Tits," when Olivia Colman is speaking.
He also says as well, like, he just says cocks.
Cocks, yeah. He just said it says random expletives at various points. God, that was fun.
That was funny. Your death scene is, I mean, that was on my walk to school. That church is 5 minutes walk around the corner from my old family house.
Right.
It was a sort of an amazing and weird experience to shoot that film in my hometown.
Were any of the locals actually a bit pissed off with the disruption?
There was, yes. Well, what happened was... as it went on, it's the same, you know this with filming, is that people are always excited for day one.
Yes.
And then once they realise that it's boring and it's going to be an obstruction to traffic.
They're going
to
close roads and yeah.
Particularly anything to do with parking, then people get like properly like murderous about that. Sure. And be really angry. And we filmed in the town square for like 10 days. And most people are on board, but there was one shop that was very prominently in position, a clothes shop. I think it's no longer there. And they started a campaign in the local paper to get rid of us.
Oh,
it's like, we're losing trade. And they had this figure, so we're losing like £400 a day because of filming. So you can't bribe these people, because if you bribe somebody, it'll get around very quickly in a small town. So the only thing that we could do is the line producer just got petty cash. And basically anybody passing, we would give them money and say, go and buy some clothes in that shop.
No way.
So my mum and dad came down to visit. And I said to Mum, Mum, here's £200, go and buy some clothes from that shop. And I was still filming, and I remember my mum brought out the clothes to me. She goes, do you think I should get this or get this? I said, I don't care, just buy it.
It's Beatles Hot Shots all over again.
Oh, this is the thing. I'm the corrupt one.
Yeah.
I'm the one who's like sort of like riddled with corruption.
That's right.
I'm the terrible evil guy. It's me. This is the twist of this podcast.
The media elite.
Is this your Frost Nixon moment?
Absolutely. Got you on the run.
One other thing that I remember that happened, like people like from my past would come up to me whilst I was filming. One time I was like, I won't even say an ex-girlfriend. A girl that, like, and this is for UK listeners, not international listeners, that I had got off with at a party. You know what got off with means? Americans don't. I now realise that.
Some lovely snogging. Kissing.
Strictly first base stuff. I got off with this girl at this party, whose name was Sarah. And then I think later at the same party, she had got off with somebody else, and I was heartbroken.
Sarah.
And that was the end of my brief dalliance with Sarah. I don't think I ever spoke to her again at school.
Quite right.
Cut to like 16 years later, filming Hot Fuzz. This lady, Sarah, who's now a woman, who's also now a mother.
She's now a woman, you say?
Now a woman. I'm standing in the street and we're about to shoot a shot, or we're setting up for a shot. And this kid has a Shaun of the Dead DVD, and he runs across the street and he says, "Mr. Wright, could you sign my DVD?" And just as I get my Sharpie out to sign it, this woman, Sarah, comes around the corner and says very loudly, this is the first time I've spoken to her, or she's spoken to me since the party.
Since the very loud,
she goes, "No, Edgar Wright, I don't want your autograph." And stormed off.
No way.
Seriously. I thought, wow, I ain't done anything wrong. I don't know why she's mad at me.
You should have called after. "You're the one that snugged the other guy at the party."
I said, "Listen, you got off with Johnny Harris after me. That's on you."
You snugged Johnny Harris as well?
No, she did. Oh. John, if you're listening, you know it's true.
Go on, pick them up high, honey. Come on. You can wiggle it now. I'm so glad for you. Swing it, honey, as hard as you can. Go on. Forget there's anyone else here. You can't believe it.
were you able to enjoy making Hot Fuzz? Do you generally enjoy yourself while you're making films, or is it just overwhelmingly tiring and stressful?
Well, my producer, Naira Park, who you know, every time I get into like sort of a pit of absolute despair on a movie, which is on every movie as it turns out,
mm-hmm.
she reminds me of the previous email that I sent when I was suicidal. So I think every movie, one thing I say, and it's funny actually getting to know like Garth Jennings, is I always, like, whenever I watch Garth at work, I was thinking, oh, I'd love to be as upbeat as Garth is making a movie. Because usually, I think whatever I am like in person normally when I'm with you, I sort of, when I'm actually shooting, I get very, I'm not like a shouter. I never like shout, but I sulk and I can get into a really like black mood. It's never like things going badly. It's just like there's always too much to do and not enough time. So I wish I could enjoy myself more on movies. Sean, I did not have a good time. There was like an element on the movie sort of conspired to sort of ruin the actual enjoyment of making it, which was really annoying.
Are you talking about just people being obtuse and...
There was one element of the crew on Shaun of the Dead that were just not on board at all and had a real sort of Jekyll and Hyde moment where they couldn't have been nicer during the prep. And then on day one of the shoot, is like they were just against the movie and me and Simon and Nick. I won't say what department because I don't want to badmouth them. But they said to me and Nick and Simon, all within the space of a day, said, remember this is film and not video, dear. I was like, fucking hell. Like, this is like a real, like, sort of like, oh, I'm being belittled on my own, like, movie.
Put you in your members. Place.
I know.
It's not Beatles Hot Shots now.
But
or maybe it is.
It was a very weird thing. And it's funny. I knew I had to get myself out of a funk about it. And, like, I think I remember on Shaun of the Dead, I got really depressed about it, like, sort of, because it was something where my dream of making the movie I wanted to make was happening. It's something that me and Simon had been trying to get together for years. And, you know, I'd made a movie when I was 20, but Shaun of the Dead felt like I have a chance to make a real movie and I can visualize it, I can see it, and I've been wanting to make this for several years now. And also, when you've made a movie when you're 20 and it didn't do that great and then you get a second chance, it's like I've literally got a second shot on my debut movie because nobody remembers the first one. And in fact, when I did press for Shaun of the Dead in the States, if people said, no, with your debut movie, Shaun of the Dead, I would never correct them.
Uh-huh.
In the UK, it was different because lots of people had reviewed it here. So it's a very strange thing. And then when suddenly there's like a element that are not on your side, It was awful.
And did you ever identify why it was that they were annoyed with you? Or?
I think they had no faith in the movie.
Right.
You know, so I'm sure just, privately, right, when me and Simon and Nick are not in earshot, they're saying, what the fuck is this shit? In fact, somebody literally, as you might imagine, you've seen me on set. I very frequently, people assume that I was probably a PA and not the actual director. Maybe not anymore, but definitely on like Shaun and Hot Fuzz, that used to happen a lot. And on Shaun of the Dead, one of the older zombies, who is not one of our friends, a lot of our friends are playing zombies in that, but one of the older zombies came up to me, assumed I was a runner, and he stood next to me, looked at the set, and he goes, whew, straight to video for this one. And I just went, yeah. Like, Hot Fuzz was different because actually everybody was on board, like the crew, and in fact every crew member except the black marks in Sean returned for Hot Fuzz, so you can probably quite easily figure it out on IMDb if you wanted to. But on Hot Fuzz it was like sort of the crew were great,
but then you had the added challenge of having this insane cast of like acting legends that you assembled. I mean, look, I've got my call sheet here.
It's incredible.
This is one day, Saturday the 3rd of June 2006. Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Timothy Dalton, Jim Broadbent, Paddy Considine, Rafe Spall, Kevin Eldon, Olivia Colman, Carl Johnson, Edward Woodward, Billy Whitelaw, Anne Reed.
I know, it's amazing.
Adam Buxton. Unbelievable. He's amazing. People, but you know, that must have been and all of those very strong personalities as well, actors with a huge amount of experience, and that
was
never,
I mean, that was never a problem actually.
Is it not?
I think what happens with those in that situation is you might be able to kind of establish actors that might be divas on other sets, but if they are confident in the film, then it'll be okay. And the good news on that was that even these big and established actors, I think because everybody else was in it as well. And I think the mood comes from the top down. And I've been very lucky on Sean and Hot Fuzz, at least, and World's End, is even if I can sometimes be in a bad mood, Simon and Nick are like the nicest guys to have at the center of a film. And when I've done movies without them, I probably had to be a lot more personable.
Right.
So on Scott Pilgrim, I think I was probably in a much better mood and a lot more personable because I'm working with a young cast and I'm in charge and I haven't got Simon and Nick.
You didn't have any of your regulars there, did you?
The crew members I did.
Oh, you did, right.
In fact, a lot of crew members, some of my crew members, like my production designer and editors and sound guys, have like remained the same since Spaced, and my producer as well. There's some people that have gone through right from Spaced all the way through to Baby Driver. But I think I would rely on Simon and Nick to be the good cops, and I could be the sulky one on set. And it's something I'm not proud of at all. I wish I could be in a better mood. And even on this new one, I reached a point in the middle of Baby Driver where I was at my lowest. And usually, I sort of realize it's just sleep deprivation, irritability, like sort of...
Malnutrition.
Malnutrition and, yeah. and sleep deprivation. And there's a point on Baby Driver where I was shooting main unit and parts of second unit, or at least overseeing the second unit at the same time. And one was a night shoot and one was a day shoot. And so I'd end up like being on set for like 20 hours and getting 4 hours sleep. There was a space for about 20 days where I was shooting every single day. And I was at absolutely incredibly bleak mood. Naira is always the one to talk me down because I'm really proud of the new movie. It's done it really well and I'm really happy about it. But it's that thing where she never like is annoying enough to say, remember when you thought it was going to be shit in the middle of the shoot? But I'm like that with every film. I always think everything's going to be shit. Right. It's not good. I mean, on the flip side, if you're really happy all the time and you're happy with everything and you're going home early, there's probably also a problem. Do you know what I mean?
Of course, yeah.
Like, if you're making a comedy and everybody's having too much of a good time, that's usually like a...
I think you can identify those films. When you see them, you just think, oh, they must have all been howling with laughter that day.
Yeah.
And it would have been great if they'd concentrated a bit more on chopping certain elements back or whatever.
Yeah, I think you can... I think sort of... That said, is it would be nice to sort of actually enjoy the process a bit more.
Yeah. Well, for us, the actors on Hot Fuzz... It was a hoot. And everyone used to hang out in the evenings when we were in Wells.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of social engagements. I remember a bowling competition one evening. Hanging out in Simon's trailer, I remember, with Paddy Considine and a few people. And I remember Paddy flipping through this big wallet of DVDs that Simon had.
Yeah.
And he had like every single Buffy the Vampire Slayer or something. And Paddy Considine was just rolling his eyes. He's like, what the fuck is all this shit you got? That's not a good impression of Paddy Considine. But I remember Simon looking a little bit hurt. Hey, that's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That's good stuff. But no, it was fun. The only time when I felt quite out of my depth was doing a scene with Tim Dalton.
Oh, he slapped you on the back pretty hard, right?
When he slapped me on the back. And like his character was supposed to be annoyed with my character, Tim yeah. Messenger. I'm the annoying local reporter. And he turns out to be, spoiler alert, you know, one of the big bad guys in the village. And he comes and he had to clap me on the back. Like quite hard. But he really genuinely did like smack me on the back. And we did it several times. So after a while, my back was stinging and also it would shock me every time so that I found it hard to deliver my line. And I think I said to him eventually, like, when you slap me on the back there, that is quite hard. Do you have to do it quite that hard? And he just looked at me like, what are you even doing here?
That would be an even funnier situation if you were playing like a... like a henchman in a Bond film.
Yeah.
Saying, Timothy, in that scene there, you when you hit me, you don't have to hit me.
I wouldn't say it in that voice.
That's the voice you did.
You don't have to punch me quite so hard. It look real. With film tricks, you can do it so that it doesn't actually hurt. I don't know if you know that. But I was thinking that, like, mate, no one's going to know if you just act slapping me on the back. They can put a sound in. You don't have to genuinely wind me every time.
I mean, he's amazing in the movie. I loved working with him. And I think afterwards, you know, like, one of the best things about him, and this is not a bad thing at all, he's just one of those people that doesn't suffer fools gladly, you know? But he's somebody also that I never really... I feel very fortunate that I didn't really have to explain how to do it. And I've had other situations where you do have to explain, like, oh, it would be so much funnier if you did it straighter. With Timothy, you never really had to say that. And, like, for somebody to come on and just nail the tone of it immediately, it was just like, oh, this is great. I couldn't think of somebody better doing that. And he slays every line that he does. It's just beautiful. But I do remember there was one thing. I'm not sure if I've ever told this story. This is actually almost going back to sort of David Walliams saying out loud the things that you're thinking.
Yeah.
So one of the things that would happen, and it would happen to him a lot, and I remember Nick Frost saying this thing about Timothy Dalton. He said, if he played James Bond, it's like as being as famous as a president. They're not former President Barack Obama or former President Jimmy Carter. They are President Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
And Bond is exactly the same. You're always James Bond. So it was an interesting thing that out of all of those actors, Jim Broadbent, Simon and Nick, Billy Whitelaw, Edward Woodward, by far the biggest amount of autographs would be for Timothy Dalton because he's Bond. And every person in that town, every publican in a location would seem to have a copy of The Living Daylights under their bar.
Right.
Somebody would be hiding in the bushes when we're shooting a scene saying, oh, Timothy. And they'd have their Bond annual or something. So you'd see he'd bristle at it a little bit because he's trying to concentrate. And I'm sure if, like, it's a blessing and a curse being James Bond. But I do remember, and this really made me laugh, we're standing in the town square. And you know that thing when parents have told their children that somebody's famous, but the children have no idea who that person is?
Yes, it's like my children.
And the parents have said, that man there is really famous. Like, go up and ask for his autograph. And maybe they've said he's James Bond, but the kids who come up and tug on his shoulder, and this is in between takes, come up and this is what they say to Timothy. Excuse me, mister, are you famous? And he just went... Under his breath, he went, oh, fuck off. Like that. To like an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old. 5 minutes later, a policewoman comes up, says, Mr. Dalton, did you just swear at two children? And he says, I don't think so. And he goes, well, they definitely think you did.
No, a real police person.
A real police person.
Oh, my goodness.
So the kids are told, said, that man swore at us. So the policewoman came up to Timothy Dalton and said, did you swear at these kids? He goes, I don't believe so. He goes, well, they definitely heard it. He says, maybe I said it under my breath, but I didn't intend for them to hear. I do apologize. So he apologized profusely. But I imagine the next part of the story that I imagine happening off screen is that policewoman went back to the station and said, oh my God, you never guess what happened today. I only had to tell off James Bond.
Wait. Continue.
There we go. Thanks to Edgar Wright for talking to me. It is the morning after my show in Birmingham. I'm in my hotel room. The show went very well last night. Really good crowd, which included Nicola, the director. You know Nicola. She directed the Travel Man episode that I was on with Richard Ayoade. And in fact, she pops up briefly on the second of the two episodes that I did with Richard. So if you've listened to those, you will have heard Nicola. She's based in Birmingham along with the rest of the Travel Man production team, some of whom came along as well last night. We had a little drink afterwards, which is unusually sociable for me. And as we were leaving the pub, a young couple came up to me and the guy said, and this is true, excuse me, mate, are you famous? Exactly like the little kids with Tim Dalton. I decided against saying fuck off under my breath. And I just went with, well, I mean, I was on Travel Man and I got killed by a church in Hot Fuzz. Does that count? And then I posed for a selfie. It's the kind of constant harassment that makes it very difficult for me to go out in public. Despite that, I was able to make it to the venue yesterday without too much hassle. It was a beautiful hot afternoon, and at one point I found myself walking through Birmingham's busy shopping district near the Bullring Mall, where due to the current terror threat level, there were armed police in flak jackets wandering amongst the happy shoppers, while representatives from some of the major religions shared their messages. I turned on my recorder and drifted between them.
and peace be upon him the day he was born, the day he dies, and the day he will be raised up to life again.
واذكر في الكتاب مريم إذ انتبذت من أهلها مكانا شرقيا فاتخذت
families and God will cover all those families in Manchester. Hallelujah. And we have to stand together. Together we stand, divided and we fall. Hallelujah. Together we stand, divided and we fall. But love conquers all. Amen. You can have prophecies. You can speak in tongues. You can do many good things.
But they probably arrested me.
Here's a little song I wrote.
You might want to learn it, not part of it, don't worry. Be happy.
In every life we have some trouble.
And when you worry, you might be in trouble, don't worry. Be happy.
Three of the big religions represented there for you. You're welcome. A bit of Islam, some Christianity, and a slice of McFerrinism on a peaceful summer's day in Birmingham. Thought it'd be nice to end with a bit of an audio picture there for you. All right. Thanks very much to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for production support and to Matt Lamont for conversation editing. I'll be back next week. Take very good care. I'm not going to shout because I'm in a hotel room. I love you. Bye.
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very...